Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
So we got into it primarily from a pet standpoint because my daughter was interested in that. But as a family, we were interested in sustainability and gardening and producing our own food.
So Alicia Kropf started a small chicken flock in her backyard in Bloomington, Indiana. She'll be joined by two other backyard chicken farmers for part one of our roundtable discussion where they answer your questions. The second half of the program keeps the chicken theme going as we throw together a stock using leftover chicken bones and some veggie scraps. And Bethia Wolf of Columbus Food Adventures introduces us to a vendor who's dedicated to providing fresh, local chickens to Columbus, Ohio customers. Stay with us. Welcome back to Mia Partlow, who was on vacation last week. She's got this week's news stories for us. Hey, Mia.
It's good to be back, Annie. This week, the New York City Board of Health approved Mayor Michael Bloomberg's plan to limit the size of soda available for sale in food service establishments. All restaurants in the city will be barred from selling sugar-sweetened drinks in cups larger than 16 ounces. Mayor Bloomberg hopes the plan will help reverse the city's obesity problem. Opponents have been making their voices heard since the ban was proposed in early June, despite the fact that over half of New Yorkers reported drinking soda only once a week or never, 60% of them oppose the ban. Officials anticipate the ban will gain approval just as the smoking ban in bars and restaurants has over the years. And pink slime is back in the news this week. Beef Products Incorporated, or BPI, sued ABC News for what they're saying was 200 false, misleading, and defamatory statements. According to BPI's attorney, ABC's reporting in March and April of this year caused consumers to believe that lean, finely textured beef is not beef at all, and that it is unsafe for public consumption. As a result, the company says it lost 80% of its business in 28 days, and it ended up closing three of its four U.S. facilities. And McDonald's has announced it will begin posting calorie counts on all of its U.S. menus beginning next week. The move is voluntary, but it comes in advance of the impending activation of a lesser-known provision contained in the Health Care Reform Act, which requires all restaurant chains with 20 or more locations to list calories alongside menu items. While many have heralded the company's new nutritional disclosure policy as an important step forward, research has been ambivalent as to whether having nutritional information out in the open in restaurants really has much of an impact on eating habits. In New York City and Newark, New Jersey, fast food chains have had to display calories on menus for a number of years. A 2011 study in those two cities revealed no reductions in caloric intake. Read more about fast food, slow food, local food, and sustainable eating on our social media platforms. We post news stories there all day, every day. Find us on Twitter and Facebook by searching for Earth Eats.
That's right, and visit our website to read more about these stories in particular and add your voice to the conversation. It's all at eartheats.org. Mia Partlow, thanks for coming in.
My pleasure.
Picking fruit, tasting wine, petting a goat, roping a cow. When customers pay for the honor of taking on such farm chores or delights, it's called agritourism. California, Texas, and Colorado have the lion's share of this business in the U.S. Still, over the last few years, farmers and policymakers in the Midwest have been trying to get in on the action. But what they've found is that even if you build it, those customers don't always come. Harvest Public Media's Camille Phillips has the story.
For a tourist attraction to succeed, customers need to be able to find it.
We're illegal to have anything on the road.
That's Renee Saba, the owner of Mule Barn Berries in Lathrop, Missouri, just north of Kansas City. On this crisp, sunny morning, she's telling a customer why there isn't a sign for Mule Barn Berries on the highway.
We're new enough that we're not sure. We don't want to be stuck with what we put up there.
This is the second year of operation for the U-Pick Blackberry Patch. Saba and her husband, Charlie, are still figuring out how to make a go of it. Last year, they didn't have enough customers come out. With bushels of berries rotting on the vine, they scrambled to find other ways to sell their fruit.
My husband said, well, call Lydia's restaurant. And just call. some restaurants, or let's pack up fruit and take it to grocery stores and see if they'll buy anything. And it was this panic moment.
Now they are better prepared, Saba says. Several area restaurants buy their berries, they've made arrangements to sell at more farmers' markets, and as a last resort, they can call gleaners to pick the remaining fruit. But U-Pick is still the focus.
U-Pick, everyone's happy. They come out, they have a great experience. I get to talk to people, which I really like. And so it's all win-win-win-win-win when it's U-Pick.
Still, the Sabas aren't over the hump.
We hoped to be profitable at the end of this year. That's not going to be reality. We spent too much money. Didn't budget well enough.
Even when the Sabas begin making a profit, odds are it won't be enough to live on. Agritourism businesses in Nebraska, Iowa, Missouri, and Kansas brought in an average of $12,300 in 2007. That's according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Ag Census. Still, policymakers in the Midwest are enthusiastic about the potential of agritourism. State governments and universities have websites, agencies, and staff devoted to developing agritourism into an industry. Linda Craighead has been promoting agritourism in Kansas for 10 years. She now works for the Kansas Department of Wildlife, Parks, and Tourism. The idea, she says, has been slow to catch on.
It's new. It's new for Kansas. It is not something that has just been, it's not something that people have really just truly embraced.
There are some pioneers, like Geringer Orchards in Edgerton, Kansas, 30 miles from Kansas City. Owner Frank Geringer farms about 1,000 acres and produces corn, soybeans, and beef cattle. That's his family's primary source of income.
Our original orchard was up here. It's getting old enough now. We've had a lot of trees die. Peach trees don't live particularly long compared to a lot of fruit trees.
But about 10 years ago, Geringer added a new crop, peaches, and invited people out to the orchard to pick. Today, he has 12 acres of peach trees, a couple of acres of blackberries, sweet corn, and 5 hoop houses full of tomatoes and other vegetables. In addition to U-Pick, Geringer and his wife Melanie sell their produce at a country store on their property and at several area farmers' markets. Inside the country store, Geringer explains that they found the best way to get people out to their orchard is to hand out flyers at those farmers' markets. And at the same time, their orchard is a big help in selling their produce at the market.
But when we set up, we only sell what we grow. And when we set up, we usually put up a U-Pick sign with us too. So people automatically key into the fact that, well, they've got to grow their stuff.
Another pioneer is Carolyn Rash in Liberty, Missouri.
And then this will be our corn maize over here that just got planted yesterday.
In 1991, she opened Carolyn's Country Cousins on her farm to sell the pumpkins and other produce she had been selling at a farmer's market. That same year, a school asked if they could bring students out to see the farm, and now 17,000 school children tour their place every year.
People used to be able to go to grandma's, grandpa's every weekend, or aunts and uncles, and now we are not one generation removed from the farm. We're 3 and 4 generations removed from the farm. Some of them have never set foot on a farm and never been out and just played in the mud and played in the dirt.
But their school tours offer a lot more than dirt. There's an animal barn, a pig race, a hay bale maze, a slide and jungle gym made of farm supplies, a train ride, and to top it off, a U-Pick pumpkin patch. Rush's sons also have a corn maze next door. One of the reasons agritourism appeals to farmers is that it takes advantage of the land, equipment, and knowledge they already possess. Rash and her husband Buddy farm full-time, as do their 2 adult sons. They use the same farm equipment and expertise to plant their 8,000 acres of row crops as they do to plant the 60-acre U-Pick pumpkin patch and corn maze.
Would you say you make more money doing agritourism than the row crops, though?
Oh, no. Oh, no, no. Row crop is our number one income. Row crop is our number one income by far.
Still, the attractions draw thousands of paying customers each year and employ 150 people each fall. That kind of success can create a ripple effect of economic growth in a rural community. Linda Craighead, with the Kansas Department of Wildlife, Parks, and Tourism, takes the potential even further, envisioning Kansas farms as vacation destinations.
But there are so many people that want to experience what we do every day. And how many people out there have really ever ridden on a combine? Very few.
A family vacation milking cows or harvesting wheat may never have the appeal of Disneyland. But for the farmers that decide to branch out into agritourism, perhaps the opportunity to share their way of life is enough, especially when it can help bring an influx of cash to their community and put a few extra $1,000s in their pocket. I'm Camille Phillips for Harvest Public Media. The
This week we're starting a three-part series where we're discussing the ins and outs of raising chickens in your backyard. We solicited questions from our Twitter followers and Facebook friends, and three veterans of the backyard chicken world have come into the Earth Eats studios to try to answer them. Today, it's all about how chickens can help, and maybe hurt, a garden. We'll start the intros with Alicia Kropf.
We have five chickens, which is the in-town limit, and we live on a small city lot. I think, is it an eighth of an acre? Is that right? I don't even know. It's tiny.
It's your backyard.
Right? It's my backyard. We live in the Bryan Park neighborhood, so they're not. These are not big lots.
I'm Jana Wilson, and I guess I'm the country chick. I live out on. I have 20 acres outside of the city, and I have anywhere from 25 in the winter to 80 to 90 in the summer because I hatch.
And I'm Tom Berich. I live just on the outskirts of Bloomington, so I'm at just outside the city limit. So I have eight birds, mixed flock, and I am starting to hatch as well. And it's very much suburbs, but just outside the city limits.
So you don't have to follow the city rules?
No, we don't.
And Alicia, let's talk about that. What are the rules that you have to follow since you are in the city of Bloomington?
Okay, well, they just changed recently. So the rules that we have to follow is you can have a limit of five birds. They all have to be hens. You can have no roosters, cockerels, anything like that. You have to have an enclosure for those birds that I believe is 60 square feet for five birds. You have to have that enclosure has to be a certain specific number of feet from every other piece, every other building nearby. So it has to be so many feet from my fence, from my neighbors, from the neighbors behind me. Mm-hmm. You no longer have to have neighborhood permission, although it's nice to tell them.
Mm-hmm. That's a change.
That is a change. Sure. That's a huge change. That's a change that happened at the city council last spring. Mm-hmm.
So then you guys who are not in the city, is it just sort of like a free-for-all? You can do whatever you want on the farm?
Well, with my experience being still in the suburbs and heavily suburbs, I have neighbors on all sides. I don't want to say that it's a free-for-all because there's a matter of neighborly courtesy that you have to keep with. And really, as long as you check with all of your neighbors, make sure that, you know, if you do let your chickens free range, which I do on occasion, you know, they're not bothering them. I do have a rooster, which is one of the things that, you know, Alicia can't do. And even though we live in the same kind of area, you know, you do want to check with them because at 6 o'clock in the morning, you're going to have this animal screaming bloody murder in the backyard.
Well, gosh, what are the perks of having a rooster other than this alarm clock?
Chicks.
That's well, and it. Predators. They help guard a flock.
Absolutely. And especially if you have your chickens free range a bit, you know, they will keep dogs away. and they'll keep other things away, though.
What breed do you have?
I have a Bard Rock rooster.
Yeah, because my roosters are completely useless.
Really?
Completely useless. They're
wow.
Lovely little birds. Sicilian buttercups.
Okay, sure.
They're small.
Yeah, the little things.
Yeah, but completely useless.
Well, so. Let's talk about your birds, because you raise interesting birds, Jana. These Sicilian buttercups.
Mm-hmm, they are. In the American Livestock Breed Conservancy listing, they used to be threatened. I believe they've taken a step up, and now they're critical. I think that's the difference. So they're not as threatened as they used to be, but there are very, very few of them around. They, as time has gone on, a lot of heritage breeds have suffered this fate of they're almost extinct because the production birds are just one or two different breeds. And so farmers, you know, quit raising various types of breeds in their backyards because it wasn't productive. It wasn't economical for them.
Let's describe what they look like. They're beautiful.
They really are. Well, the most distinctive feature about them is their comb. It's a cup, a circular cup on top of their head. The comb is, mm-hmm. is you could put, an egg inside of a male's comb. It's a very large comb. And the females are a beautiful golden color with a spangling from their shoulders back, the black spangling. And they're great egg layers.
They are.
Yeah, they're like the leghorn. Mm-hmm.
Do they work as dual purpose at all? Do you eat them?
I do eat them. Mm-hmm. I do eat them. They're not considered a meat bird or mm-hmm. production bird. Like most egg-laying birds, most of their energy goes right. into the eggs. And so they're pretty skinny little things. Yeah. Hence those wimpy males
yeah,
are
the roosters
not
you don't do
really
anything.
Good at fending off predators.
Sure. We're talking about what you use your chickens for. So we've got eggs and for meat.
What are some of the other things that chickens give you?
I can answer that one. For us, anyway. So we got into it primarily from a pet standpoint because my daughter was interested in that. But as a family, we were interested in sustainability and gardening and producing our own food. And because some of ours have a pet designation, they're never going to be marked for the axe. They just never will be. But I use my chickens primarily for eggs. I also use their droppings for compost in all my gardens.
Yes, absolutely.
And based on what I have planted where, I funnel them into different areas of my yards to do my tilling because they're much more efficient. And I'm a really lazy gardener. And if I can put my chickens in there for a day and they can dig up everything and turn all the soil,
absolutely,
it's better for me.
Yeah. And you want to move them frequently because, as Alicia said, they'll tear up anything, which is, if you want them to tear up stuff, it's great. But if you don't, you have to keep moving them around or they will turn any patch of earth, grass into dirt. So, mine too.
They like to go under and do their thing.
And they don't eat the vegetables?
I found that mine go for the bugs first.
Well, the thing we've discovered is that in regards to the vegetables and the bugs, yes, they absolutely are going to go for the bugs first. But the problem is if you've got bugs on tomatoes, they're just going to spear the tomatoes. Right. They'll actually destroy the tomatoes that way.
And that's terrible.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, not for the chicken.
No, exactly. That's delicious for them.
There are ways around it. You know, we have a small garden area, and I do plant things that will spill out over so that they can eat what comes over the fence. Or, you know, there are people who plant like a moat, like between where their garden is, not a literal moat full of water, but like you'll dig out so there's space so a chicken can't put its head through the fence and actually get the vegetables. Yeah. Or you can do other plants. I'll plant various tomatoes and things around my yard for them to free range in. Mm-hmm. So
kids are pretty tenacious, you know.
They are.
They'll stick their heads out and really go for a lot if they're inside of a fence. Yes. They're very tenacious.
I have a grape arbor that they're just, I've had to really, it's like grape Fort Knox. I mean, we have to really, really, really clean it.
I mean, the cliche is the chickens are dumb, but and while that may be, they're actually very wily. They're survivors.
They are. Next week, Alicia, Jana, and Tom will talk about protecting their birds from predators and disease. If you're impatient, listen to the complete conversation on our website right now, eartheats.org. Coming up.
The things that are good for the stocks we keep in one bucket, and the things that are good for composting we put in another bucket. But these are all flavorful things that a lot of people throw away.
Chef Daniel Orr makes a chicken stock with vegetable peelings and scraps. No need to compost these tasty bits. Before that, more chicken. We visit Columbus, Ohio with Bethia Wolf to talk to a vendor at the North Market who sells the freshest birds. Stay with us.
Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods. Fresh, local, organic food with delis at all three locations and a garden center on East 3rd Street. Bloomingfoods.coop. And Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels at the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, one block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness Massage and Yoga, 812-337-3529 or 33RELAX.
Welcome back to Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan. Columbus, Ohio boasts a vibrant local food scene thanks in part to the many small farms that are within a 100-mile radius of the city. We visited Columbus in 2011 to get a feel for how Ohio foodies eat. Here's a hint. Meat eaters have a lot of great options to choose from. Let's meet our tour guide.
I'm Bethia Wolf from Columbus Food Adventures. Well, we're at the North Market, which is Columbus's only remaining public market. The city originally had four, and this is the survivor. It's in an old warehouse building close to downtown, and this is its third location. It's been in this building since 1995.
Wolf runs tours of foodie hotspots around Columbus, so she knows the North Market like the back of her hand. A vendor positioned right at the entrance is North Market Poultry and Game. In addition to local chickens, they sell ducks from Indiana, turkeys from Miami County, Ohio, rabbits and venison from Licking County, Ohio. Jerry Bullock has been running the store for 16 years.
99% of our poultry comes from Ohio or Indiana, and we try to keep it close, keep a low carbon footprint, and keep the money in the local economy, and keep the land from falling in the hands of developers by making it profitable for farmers. And
in the case today are about a dozen or so whole chickens, which he says will be sold by the end of the business day, no problem.
We have two chicken farmers. One of them brings it Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday, and we have another farmer that brings it in Friday. So the chicken is, you know, just days from harvest, not weeks like the grocery store. And so people are getting the freshest product. In fact, it's better if they take it home and let it sit for a day or two to let it age and get softer.
Around the corner is another branch of the business, Kitchen Little.
So here they're using their meats and poultry and making food for people who are shopping at the market or working nearby to eat. So they have things like chicken pot pie, they have cassoulet, which is one of their signatures, they have a chicken meatloaf.
Are you a meat eater?
Yes.
So of the things on this menu, what's your favorite?
I think the most popular dish they do is the cassoulet. They have that all the time.
Yeah, I don't know what that is. Explain that to me.
Cassoulet is a dish that comes from southwestern France, just on the foothills of the eastern side of the Pyrenees on the Mediterranean south. It's named after the earthen pot that it's cooked in, and it's deglazed from the top. You put it in the oven, and the more you deglaze it on the top, the better. I think there's a rule that says seven times or something. It consists about one-third meat. The meats are usually pork sausages, goose, duck. There's even one region where lamb is prevalent in cassoulet. But in France, it's said that cassoulet is a way to argue because there is no one recipe. And you know, the only rules are the white haricot beans and the big cassoulet earthenware pot and the stock.
So how are people responding to that dish in the North Market?
Very well. I mean, it's something that not too many people cook in the area. It's, you know.
Yeah, it's. I think one of the reasons why it's popular for people to buy is it's really labor intensive. I think it takes them about 3 days to make the full batch because they cook the beans separately, they cook the meat separately, then they put the dish together. It's a very involved dish to make. One of the things that I like about Kitchen Little is that not only is everyone that works here really passionate about the food that they make, but it varies a little bit day to day. So they don't follow a really strict recipe. So one day you might come in and the cassoulet is kind of smoky and it's got lots of the bison bacon in it. And then another day you'll come in and it has a slightly different flavor profile because they vary what meats are in it, what ingredients, and who makes it. So it's always a little different.
We didn't get to taste the cassoulet, unfortunately. It wasn't ready yet. If you tackle this tricky dish, let us know how it turns out. And, you know, why not even send us a recipe while you're at it? Connect with us on our website, eartheats.org. Chef Daniel Orr reuses everything, if at all possible, even the bones and carcasses from his leftover roasted chickens. Today in the kitchen, he'll be making good use of that and some veggie scraps by making a stock.
All stocks are pretty similar. Stock in French is a fond, F-O-N-D, meaning a foundation, which is the base of all cooking. So stocks are important things to know. And a lot of people, they're very simple, but a lot of people have forgotten how to make it. They buy, you know, canned or packaged chicken stock or veggie stock or beef stock or whatever. But you could also just as easily make it at home. And what I always suggest is if you have a roasted chicken or something like that, save the bones, put them in a plastic bag, throw it in the freezer. And then when you get enough bones and veggie scraps, then you make a stock. So what I've got here is a pot. Nice big pot, and I've got some chicken bones. Now, today I'm making a brown chicken stock, which means that I've gone ahead and roasted the bones. I've got them nice and caramelized and brown. So we've got those in there. And then we put the aromats, or the flavorings. Bay leaf, a little bit of rosemary, some fresh thyme. Those are your standard aromats. And then we're going to add our vegetables. And we always keep a bucket around the restaurant. The things that are good for the stocks we keep in one bucket, and the things that are good for composting we put in another bucket. But these are all flavorful things that a lot of people throw away, and you might as well use them for your stock instead. So here we've got the some stems from some rosemary, some onion peels, carrot peelings. Let's see what else we got here in another bucket. Oh, we got some mushroom peels. So that all goes in your pot.
And then what you want to do is kind of press all those ingredients down to get most of the air out. And the reason you're doing that is that you want to put just enough water to cover your items in the pot. Because if you put too much in, it's going to be very liquidy. It won't be a very vibrant, strong, flavored stock. All right, so we've added the water. And we're going to bring that to a boil. Then we'll simmer chicken stock for about 2.5 hours. A vegetable stock, you really only need to simmer for about 45 minutes. Beef stock, usually you can let it go for several hours, 5-6 hours, and just let it simmer away.
Earlier this month, Indiana's Chamberlain Farms recalled cantaloupes after the fruit was linked to a deadly outbreak of salmonella. This week, it was their watermelons. No illnesses have yet to be linked to the watermelons, but the farm is voluntarily recalling them as a precaution. Last week, Chef Orr harvested a watermelon from his garden for our puree recipe. This week, he's doing it with cantaloupe. Why not?
This actually works with kind of those winter melons, too, because we're making a syrup to go over them. So if the melons aren't really quite sweet enough, this will actually make them taste better than they actually are. All right, so what I like to do when I'm squeezing limes is just put a fork in and then twist, and that way you get a lot more juice out of it, and then you can just kind of squeeze that down.
And I see that you've sort of sliced off the zest already.
Right, we've zested them already, so that's going to be in the syrup at the end.
So the juice and the zest.
Right. The juice is the acidic part, and the zest will give us the perfume. All right, so we're going to throw this in a pot with some sugar. And then we're going to throw in our ginger. We've got chopped ginger. All right, and we're also just going to add about 1.5 cups of water. And we're just going to bring this to a boil, let the sugar liquefy, and then we'll toss it all together with the zest and the fruit. Now I'm going to bring the syrup over, and while it's still nice and hot, I'm going to add my lime zest. And I didn't want to put that in earlier because I want it to stay nice and green. And we're just going to sprinkle the syrup over the top of the fruit salad and pop it in the fridge. The hot syrup on the ripe fruit will kind of bruise it and give it a very intense flavor. And this is great. We'll have leftover syrup. I know that was a lot of sugar, but we're going to have plenty of syrup, and we can use this in all different things. You could make cocktails with it. You could use it on other different types of fruit, even use it in marinades and things. All right, and that's as simple as it gets.
Find these recipes on our website, eartheats.org. While you're there, you can read tips about how to keep your kitchen as clean and safe as possible. You can also get gardening tips if you want to start growing your own fruit, or find information on area farmers so you can get to know the person growing your food. Plenty of resources at your fingertips at eartheats.org.
Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, fresh local organic food with delis at all three locations and a garden center on East 3rd Street. bloomingfoods.coop, and Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels at the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, one block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness, massage and yoga, more at touchstonewellness.com. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Thanks to everyone who helps make Earth Eats possible, including Tom Barrich, Ayabon Binder, Sarah Gordon, Alicia Kropp, Liz Leslie, Chef Daniel Orr, Bethia Wolf, Jana Wilson, and the entire reporting team at Harvest Public Media. And thank you for listening. I'm Annie Corrigan.